Radio EcoShock.
Is the United Kingdom facing a climate collapse like nothing in human history? Laurie Leyburn is a visiting professor at the University of Exeter's Global Systems Institute and at both Chatham House and Institute for Public Policy Research. He appears often in European publications, TV, and radio. From the UK, Laurie Leyburn, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
It's very good to be with you.
In October, you and eight co-authors released a report called The Security Blind Spot: Cascading Climate Impacts and Tipping Points Threaten National Security. Say security and we think armies, weapons, anti-terrorism. As an introduction, why is climate change a pressing national security issue?
I think the way to think of this is to think back to the COVID-19 pandemic. One of the main things that COVID did was remind us that our security, the security of our communities, of our countries, of the whole world, is dependent not just on what governments call malicious action, not just acts of terror or war. The threats to security also come from diseases. In the case of COVID, that threat stressed our economies, it stressed our society's cohesion, it stressed our government. Everything was stressed. This was the greatest threat to global security since the Second World War, and it didn't come from any war. And so when we think of security, we need to expand our understanding of that beyond malicious action like terrorism and war, and think about the threats to that security coming from the consequences of the misuse and abuse of nature. Back then, a pandemic, now increasingly climate change.
Well, let's bring this to life for listeners. Laurie, could you describe events with climate-driven roots that destabilize food and then society in the United Kingdom?
We've had an example of this recently. Like many countries around the world, Britain has suffered from an inflationary shock. Prices have increased very rapidly, and that's really squeezed people's pockets and caused a cost of living crisis. A big factor playing into that inflation, into that increase in prices, has been the price of food. And evidence shows that as much as a third of the increase in food prices has resulted from climate causes. So extreme weather events, floods and storms and drought have impacted various crop-growing regions, both in Britain and in Europe. And the effects of that have knocked into each other, have added up to something greater than the sum of their parts. And that has led to as much as a third of the food price increases in Britain being connected back to those climate extremes.
Picking a case study from your new report, the risk of collapse of ocean currents in the North Atlantic is too huge to imagine. Some of our listeners know about AMOC, the Atlantic Meridional Overturning Circulation. Could you give us a brief explanation of what that is?
So think of it like a great conveyor belt moving warm water northwards up the Atlantic. So the warm water in the tropics around the equator is moved on the surface of the ocean northward until it reaches the far North Atlantic, where then it releases that heat and the water sinks into the abyssal depths of the ocean, into the depths, and then it travels south again like a conveyor to then rise to the surface at the equator and pick up that heat and move northward again. It is one of the reasons why Britain has vineyards at roughly the same latitude as Canada has polar bears. It's like a big sort of central heating system for the Atlantic region and the wider world.
And new science about ocean current collapse, both past and future, seems to come out pretty well monthly. Are you familiar with the new paper from Utrecht University researcher René van Westen about AMOC collapse impact?
Yes, and this is the paper that is showing the potentially huge drops in temperature as a result of AMOC collapse.
Yes, and they found he was thinking it would happen over a 100-year period. Others are not so sure, but North Europe could drop 10 degrees Celsius. So London might go as low as minus 40 degrees in February, for example. That's hard to comprehend.
It is hard to comprehend. I mean, this would be a profound reorganization of how the climate works in those places. And What I am particularly worried about is the research that's been done to look at the consequences for, say, food production. So a paper by colleagues at the University of Exeter showed that as a result of the cooler conditions, the far colder conditions, as well as the fact that an AMOC collapse could also make these places drier, it could effectively eradicate crop growing across the British Isles. And those severe effects, those threats to food, go beyond just Britain. And a paper that was commissioned for the OECD, the rich countries think tank, anticipated that the effects of AMOC collapse combined with the other effects of climate change that would be happening alongside it could lead to the loss of well over half the suitable growing area for wheat and for maize or corn, others call it corn, across the world. And that is an outcome that the OECD described as catastrophic for the global food system. And I think that does a reasonable job of summarizing the threat there.
Yes, here on Radio EcoShock, we talked with scientists working on this, like Lev Kassizer and Suzanne Ditlevsen and Johannes Lohmann, and they were looking for early warning signs that the North Atlantic overturning system is failing. Was your team able to evaluate these warning signs?
So we looked at the existing evidence that we've got, and we looked at it from the perspective of a risk assessor. A risk assessor is a profession that exists in all sectors. Think of an aviation manufacturer. They have risk assessors that are trying to basically rule out the worst cases. And when they look at that information, they have to be sure that they can, well, rule out those worst cases. And the evidence that we have seen, particularly from the latest Earth System Science, some of which you've mentioned, is, well, twofold. One, we cannot rule out the potential collapse of AMOC over the course of this century. And second, there is growing evidence to suggest that the trigger point in which collapse could start is far sooner than we realized. And this was hammered home a couple of weeks ago, in the middle of October this year, when the leading Earth system scientists who focus on this issue wrote a joint letter to the Nordic Council of Ministers, the big Nordic meeting point for their government, saying this should no longer be considered as something that is very, very low probability, and it is time to take this threat extremely seriously.
Well, with what we know so far, what would you say the odds are of an AMOC collapse this century?
Well, I'm not an Earth System scientist, so I would point to those who have the greatest expertise here. One scientist who is particularly well respected and in many ways is one of the world-leading AMOC scientists is a scientist called Professor Stefan Ramsdorf. He used to say that he thought the chances of collapse occurring this century are 10% or less. He now says he thinks it's 50-50. He thinks it's a coin toss. And I think that's quite a remarkable change and one that is consistent across a number of people who look at AMOC. So for me, to be honest, even if we thought that the probabilities were as low as, say, 10%, that is in no way reassuring, because even a 10%, even a 1%, even a 0.1% chance of something catastrophic happening to the global food system is too high. If you were to get on a plane and the pilot radioed at the beginning and said, oh, and just to let you know, there is a 1%, 10%, 50% chance that this plane could abruptly fall out of the sky, we would not tolerate that level of risk. And I do not think that we should tolerate that level of risk in the Earth system. But it is the case, effectively, implicitly, and I think unbeknownst to many world leaders, it is the case that actually we are currently, as far as we know, tolerating that level of risk in the Earth system.
Well, this big change wouldn't be instant like in the movie The Day After Tomorrow. Do we have guesses on how long collapse would take, how much time there might be for adaptation or migration, if that's necessary, if it tips?
Yeah, so that's quite right. So I think a good thing for those who are listening, an image to have in their mind is a chair. And imagine you're leaning back on that chair. I used to do it at school a lot, and my teachers would tell me off. And you reach a point where you are no longer able to hold yourself in balance as you lean back. That is the tipping point. After that, you cannot help but fall onto the floor on your back. As you're saying with AMOC, the falling process where you lose control and the chair then tips down, for AMOC collapse to play out could take decades. It could take upward of a century. We don't know. Not knowing is highly unreassuring. But We should therefore look at the riskiest case, that it could be a matter of decades, which time this could play out. That would allow for some action to be better adapted. But I really would put AMOC collapse into the category of things that are unmanageable and therefore must be avoided. There isn't much going back from the kind of impact on the food system that's being suggested by the evidence. It wouldn't just be the immediate consequences of that loss of food production. It would then be the knock-on, the cascading consequences. Not just the loss of food, it's then the economic and geopolitical instability, the health effects, the knock-on effects for nature. They will create an impact that is far greater than the sum of its parts. So we've got to make sure that we avoid this unmanageable event. Climate change is not just about the floods in Spain or the hurricanes in America. It is about those things. They're awful. But it is also about the potential for the global food system to be hit by a catastrophic event by this. And this is why scientists have been calling this an emergency and why we must see it as an emergency.
So would the impact of a North Atlantic stoppage be limited to the Atlantic, to North Europe and Scandinavia?
No. It would be a global cataclysm. I don't think we should describe it anything but that. It is a major part of the global climate system, and it would have all sorts of impacts across the world. Let me just give you one example. It would severely disrupt all tropical monsoons. So we're seeing a situation in which that critical weather pattern, the monsoon in places across Africa and across Asia and India and so on, they would be dangerously disruptive, and the knock-on consequences for billions of people would be severe.
We will be right back with more on AMOC collapse and climate security in the UK with Laurie Leybourne. Then it's off to Ireland. Stay tuned.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is UK researcher, author, and strategist Laurie Leybourne. He led the latest report, The Security Blind Spot. Well, new to me in your report, you find a subset of the AMOC current that is also vulnerable to weakening or even stopping. Please introduce us to the SPG, the subpolar gyre.
So this, as you say, is a part of that conveyor belt of the AMOC, and it's a part of it where the water sinks deep. The technical term is deep convection in the North Atlantic subpolar gyre, but scientists call the potential for this to break down, they call it SPG collapse, to echo the AMOC collapse. And the evidence shows that this subset of the AMOC could collapse. It could break down far sooner and indeed far quicker than the overall AMOC collapse. And there is growing evidence to show that the risk of that is pretty high at this moment.
Yes, but the SPG is extremely large, a whirlpool hundreds of miles away from the coast of the UK or Ireland, and part of it swirls near Labrador, Canada. How can that affect weather and agriculture in the UK?
It's because it is a key part of that process that balances the whole regional climate across the North Atlantic region. So it's a crucial part of that process by which heat is brought up and released over that entire region that you're describing. So if it were to break down, if it were to no longer be working, it would severely disrupt the ability for that heat to exist across the North Atlantic region.
And your report warns we are flying blind on the SPG, and it may even have already tipped. And our guest scientist from Australia, Dr. Matthew England, published similar warnings about the weakening of the Antarctic overturning circulation. He said that might have tipped. I wish more scientists in the North would include this global current change in threat estimates for collapse of AMOC. Aren't they all connected?
They are all connected. And it is striking to me that there has not been the level of investment into the risk assessment of these things that is commensurate with the scale of threat that they pose. Hundreds of millions is spent by governments on risk assessing numerous things, including, say, terror threats. And I'm not contesting that, but it is clear to me that if something like SPG collapse happened, or goodness forbid, AMOC collapse happened, they would lead to far greater negative impacts than many of the threats that governments are looking at, and therefore it requires the investment to better understand the connections between them. And also the early warning systems. You pointed there to the fact that we cannot rule out that some of these systems might already have been tipped. We don't necessarily notice huge signs of that, in that we might anticipate far colder extremes to be occurring, say, in Britain and then Western Europe right now if SPG had collapsed. But the fact that we don't have the early warning systems to even know if the process has started is very concerning, to say the least. It would be equivalent to, in late 2019, as the COVID pandemic was beginning to spread globally, it would be the equivalent of us not having the early warning systems that the World Health Organization had, for example. And that's why we think it's proportionate to say we are flying blind into the threat of these ocean circulation collapses, and indeed other major climate threats.
Well, these are dangerous odds of big threats, but that's not really what the UK government is telling the public so far. If I ask the Met Office, they say a collapse is an unlikely possibility. And they cite another government-funded study that reviews North Atlantic science and finds, quote, no clear overall trend in the AMOC. What do you make of officials that seem to be downplaying the AMOC threat so far?
Well, I think, and this kind of gets to the heart of the way we talk about climate risk. So I don't think that officials and many technical analysts are necessarily downplaying the threat. They are using a language that is appropriate for their particular community, that their particular community uses. So, for example, let's take another technical organization, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC. In the past, it has said, it no longer says this, but in the past, in past report, it said that the chances of an AMOC collapse occurring this century are very unlikely, and that it had medium confidence in that statement. Now, to a climate scientist, they know the technicalities of that language, but to a politician or a national security risk assessor, they don't necessarily know the subtleties there. And the subtleties are this: by very likely, what the IPCC was meaning was that there was up to a 10% chance of collapse. And by saying medium confidence, it meant, well, hang on a minute, this is highly complex. We don't necessarily have the tools to understand this in the way we might like. So we don't have huge confidence over this. But that shouldn't be reassuring, because not knowing could mean the situation is far worse. And indeed, when we do risk assessment, we might be prudent to assume it could be far worse. So there's a clash of language, a cultural context that is often missing. And that's really important to get over. A different way maybe to frame or just to repeat back what the IPCC was saying then was, we cannot rule out AMOC collapse occurring this century. Or to maybe make it even better, we cannot rule out an event that could eventually lead to the loss of well over half of the growing area for the two crucial global crops underpin the global food system. So there is this sort of a lack of translation, a lack of cultural understanding between these different approaches to language and risk assessment.
But the UK government does have a climate change risk assessment. Are you saying that does not currently include any security risks?
It does include some risks we could say are related to security, things like worsening storms and heat waves and so on. The climate change risk assessment that is done, and we're now, the fourth edition is being worked on, is extremely useful and indeed in many ways world leading. The UK government uses it to then inform its adaptation planning and has done now for many, many years. But it is not a national security risk assessment in the sense that it looks at the overall picture of what climate change could do to the country. A good example of this is that the questions that we need to ask when it comes to those security threats are, well, what is the worst that climate change could do to our food supply, and how would that interact with geopolitics and trade and competition between China and Russia, and how might it affect the Russia-Ukraine war if there was a major a breadbasket shock, an extreme weather event to the food growing areas in Ukraine? These are the kind of big security questions that, through no fault of anyone, are out of the scope of the current climate change risk assessment. So we think it's proportionate to have a more security-focused one as well, to complement it. And there are instances of that happening around the world. A good example for the UK is that the Labour Party has just won the general election here that happened in the summer, Australia's Labour Party won in 2022. And when they came into government, they commissioned two types of risk assessments for climate change. One is very similar to the British climate change risk assessment that looks at the process by which climate change will lead to flooding and storms to inform how it's going to adapt its infrastructure. But it did another one that Britain hasn't done yet, which was a national security risk assessment of climate change. And we think it's about time for Britain to do that similar exercise as well.
We know the American Pentagon studied climate threats and maybe possible climate weapons. They did this even during Republican oil-friendly governments. What about the British military establishment? Maybe are they ahead of their own government on climate security risks?
In my experience, defense departments and militaries, yes, are ahead of some parts of government. I think that's a natural consequence of their mandate, which is longer term. For example, decisions about investment in various equipment like naval ships, aircraft carriers, they are decisions that are made now, but a government will live with for decades, in some cases, maybe a century, dependent on the reuse of that equipment over time, it's sold to other nations and so on and so forth. So naturally, they are thinking in longer time cycles, and they also think at the strategic level of how the world and the context for their work might shift. But we have to be slightly careful about how, as we better understand the security threats of climate change and act on them, we don't just think of that through the lens of defense, which goes back to what we talked about first in this discussion, which is that in COVID, with COVID-19, things like pandemics were, of course, part of the context, the potential threats, the risks that militaries were picking up about around the world in the lead up to COVID. But in the actual advent of COVID, militaries didn't have a huge role to play. They played an important role in Britain, like other nations. They played a logistical role, effectively a humanitarian role. They helped move equipment and ensure that the country's response was as effective as possible. But beyond that tactical role, there wasn't a huge amount they could do because it required a strategy that included public health and public finances and economic stability and on and on and on. And we have to think of the climate security threat in a similar way. We might need militaries to provide logistical support, to play a role in horizon scanning future threats. But at the end of the day, this is an economic strategy issue. This is a political and social cohesion issue, and on and on. And it's that level of security planning, a grand strategy to survive the climate crisis that we now sorely need.
Laurie, what are next steps for this alarming threat that you report, and do you hope for better with the relatively new government led by Prime Minister Starmer?
I think that government is off to a good start. It has put security and civil resilience, by that I mean the resilience of our society in the whole, at the top of its agenda. When the government came in, our public inquiry over here into the COVID-19 pandemic released a report that said similar things about COVID that we're saying about climate, to be honest, that the assessment and preparedness to the pandemic threat, that there were big gaps in what the government was doing, and there are similar gaps with climate change. And the government has said it will respond by undertaking a national review of its resilience policies. And we think that's a really good starting point for this new government to overcome the failures of previous governments. So I feel more than ever we have the opportunity to really put resilience and human and ecological security at the forefront of our approach to climate change in the UK. And that's partly because we lived through, in some ways, a very tragic, very damaging dry run of the type of destabilizing society-wide international shocks that climate could bring. That was COVID, and governments saw their shortcomings during that, and we have an opportunity to overcome them for climate change now.
Laurie, what is the Strategic Climate Risks Initiative?
This is a part of the work that we're doing around this agenda going forward. The idea of the Strategic Climate Risks Initiative, or SCRI, is to look at what we could characterize as the next chapter of the climate crisis. It is a even more difficult one. It is a chapter in which more of these security risks will manifest. It's one in which tipping point risks will grow. Some tipping points might even be triggered. And the world will increasingly head over the 1.5 degree temperature limit. That doesn't mean that we have lost, as it were. It does not mean that the climate change has overcome us or that the action is futile. In fact, the opposite. It just means that the strategic context for that work is becoming more difficult. In some ways, you could think of it like a ship heading towards a storm. The best thing to do is to change your bearing and sail round. But that didn't happen. So now the ship is in the storm. The world is in the climate crisis. And you've still got to change the bearing and sail away, but your ability to do that has to contend with the impacts of the storm on the boat. We're going to have to navigate increasingly severe climate shocks. They're already here. They will get worse. And we have to improve our ability to spot them and to make sure our societies are resilient. So ultimately, we can stay focused on decarbonizing no matter what climate change throws at us. So ultimately, we manage to navigate out of the literal and figurative storm.
From the UK, we've been talking with author and strategist Laurie Leyburn. He led the new report, The Security Blind Spot, Cascading Climate Impacts and Tipping Points Threaten National Security. You can find that at www.ippr.org, ippr.org, or use the link in my own show blog at ecoshock.org. The report is really readable, and I think everyone should take a look. Laurie, thank you for sharing time and insight with our listeners.
It's always a pleasure. Thank you.
For Radio EcoShock, I'm Alex Smith.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.